shortly thereafter. But nonetheless, I'm really grateful for this opportunity. Let's begin by looking at some interesting scientific questions. Well, let's begin actually with an uninteresting scientific question. What happens when I collide two gold nuclei at very large energies? That in and of itself is a question you would ask only out of idle curiosity. But as endorsed by the US National Academy of Science and others, an interesting question is, are there new states of matter that can be achieved at the highest temperatures and densities? And indeed, what is the highest achievable temperature? But for my taste, a truly compelling question is, are there fundamental thermal properties of gauge theories that can be tested via experiment? And I hope to convince you this morning that the answer is indeed yes. So let's begin by considering the thermal universe. And indeed, at these very large temperatures you see up here of order 10 to the 12 Kelvin, were achieved, of course, in the early universe in the first few microseconds. Those conditions prevailed somewhere between 1 and 10 microseconds after the Big Bang. And that, in and of itself, has been a very useful motivation for proceeding with the study of relativistic heavy ions. And you can see that encoded in this. It's not the particle physics wall chart, but it's the nuclear physics wall chart, circa the year 2000. And if you blow up this region up here, this is the area of the chart that pertains to the study of thermal properties of nuclear matter. You can see on this as a function of, well, it's mislabeled. It really should be net baryon density in this axis versus temperature. The prevailing viewpoint of what would be achieved in Rick collisions in simulating the early universe up in this regime, and encoded in that is the notion that Rick would create a so-called weakly interacting quark-gluon plasma of quarks and gluons. And you can see that in some sense in that the density in this region becomes smaller than it is over here. That was also greatly prejudiced by the lattice results from that period of time. Here is plotted as a function of the temperature scaled by the critical temperature, in effect, the number of degrees of freedom. Recall that the number of massless degrees of freedom non-interacting is given by this expression, the energy density divided by T to the fourth. There's a factor of pi squared over 30. So other than that factor of essentially a third, this axis plots the number of degrees of freedom divided by 3. And you can see the increase in the degrees of freedom as you exceed the critical temperature. And it's nicely verified as you change the number of active flavors on the lattice. One goes from 2 to 3 flavors, and you see the corresponding increase in the number of degrees of freedom. Over here in this corner of the plot, you see the corresponding expectations for the so-called Stefan-Boltzmann limit, in which you really do count degrees of freedom for quarks and gluon as per this formula. And then the notion was is that these rough lattice calculations came rather close to their corresponding Stefan-Boltzmann within a factor of about 20%. And that was good enough for government work, indeed, that we expected to see an asymptotically free quark-gluon plasma. So the plan circa the year 2000 for the Rick accelerator was to use, at that time, the truly unprecedented access to a much larger center of mass energy to use perturbative QCD probes to probe the plasma via the auto-generated hard processes and to find a clear evidence for or against quark-gluon plasma. An important component of the program also turned out to be polarized proton-proton collisions. The polarization is irrelevant for the purposes of this talk, but it's been useful in understanding the contributions to the spin of the proton. The plan was to have two small detectors, two large detectors with complementary capabilities. The small detectors envisioned to have sort of a 3 to 5 year lifetime, and the larger detectors were regarded as facilities, and the intent was to take advantage of their longer lifetimes and to upgrade them in situ. Rick looks something like this in an aerial view. The two small experiments, Brahms and Phobos, are located here. The two large experiments, Phoenix and Star, you get some idea of their relative apertures and their relative capabilities by looking at their event displays. That's about all I'll say about the actual experimental apparatus. So that gives you an idea of how they each sample the tremendous multiplicity that occurs in a gold-on-gold collision. And of course, this display has become iconic, and you can find it on calendars and book covers everywhere. Since that time, since the year 2000, the accelerator complex has been tremendously successful. It routinely operates at 2 to 4 times the design luminosity for the machine. more so than any other accelerator, or collider at least, in history, it's dealt with a huge variety of colliding species. That has never been done before in the breadth that you see in the RIC program. First, for the experiments, the key thing is that they worked. There were indeed doubters as to whether the experiments would even be able to handle the large multiplicities. From those working experiments have emerged more than 200 refereed publications, and in fact, among them, more than 100 PhysRev letters and some major discoveries. And there's a future for this program. We've demonstrated capability to upgrade and identified some key science questions for the future. So the approach, how can I provide to you the results of 200 scientific papers? Well, I'm going to, in effect, provide essentially the results of 1% of those papers, two major discoveries from RIC. But what I'll do is we'll do some sample of the results from the final stage of the collision process, where we expect to see thermal behavior, the initial state where we identify hydrodynamic flow as a characteristic feature, and then the high PT, high transverse momentum probes of the dense matter. So let's begin, but before doing that is I'll simply make an assertion, is another key aspect of the physics at RIC has been our unprecedented control of something that to a particle physicist is quite surprising. Geometry matters, and the geometry of the collision is a key feature in understanding these. And I'll sometime lapse into jargon. One of the ways in which we a posteriori express this geometry is in the degree of overlap in the collision. These are beam's eye view of the two nuclei as they collide. And we'll refer to central collisions that overlap, well, not quite maximally here, versus peripheral collisions. And those are labeled in a fashion 0 to 10% refers to the 10% most central collisions. It's also been very important to understand the overlap of the nuclei with respect to the reaction plane and the orientation of the reaction products, the particles that emerge with respect to the reaction plane. So having said that, let's begin with the final state. If we're going to study thermal gauge theories, we better be able to establish that indeed thermalization has occurred. I won't provide the evidence for that. I'll simply tell you that the yield of all of the particle species, from the lightest, the pions, to the heaviest, the omega baryon, are consistent with thermal production at a temperature not unlike the lattice transition temperature of 170 MeV and a baryon chemical potential of 30 MeV. That's small compared to the temperature, so that means that at least the central region of these collisions is essentially free of net baryon number. So in a lot of what follows, I'll essentially assume that this chemical potential can be neglected. Let's then discuss what the two major discoveries from RIC have been. They are the discovery of what's referred to as elliptic or strong hydrodynamic flow by the STAR collaboration. Here's the iconic plot from their first paper. And this, the discovery of jet quenching by the Phoenix collaboration, the large suppression of high transverse momentum particles that emerge from the material created at RIC. So let's go on then and look at the hydrodynamic flow first. What that is the imprint of the initial spatial asymmetry in the collision on the final state production of the particles with respect to the reaction plane. What does that mean? Well, let's look at the initial geometry. The initial geometry now here shown in a somewhat more three-dimensional form. In general, you never have a precisely central collision. There is always some almond-shaped overlap region in the collision. And I apologize, I knew I was going to do that. That gets translated into a final state asymmetry of the production of particles with respect to the reaction plane. Here you see that modulation about the reaction plane. This is the azimuthal angle around the beam axis of this oblate surface. And these are the data. And you see that there is a very large modulation approaching 40% for the so-called mid-peripheral collisions. That is, we do a Fourier analysis. We don't do a multiple analysis out to L equals 10 or 100 or 1,000 like our CMB friends. We do it just out to 2. Here is that Fourier analysis of that azimuthal distribution. And the key coefficient is this so-called V2, which is a function of the transverse momentum of the emitted particles. And this simply describes the height of the modulation of this pattern. If we plot that Fourier coefficient versus the transverse momentum, you see that there is a separate distribution for the pions, kaons, and protons, that is, mass matters. And the curves that you see on there are the results of ideal hydrodynamics, perfect fluid hydrodynamics, in describing that flow pattern. And it's important to realize that that region of transverse momentum encompasses about 98% of the produced particles. So indeed, the flow appears to be hydrodynamic. But we can actually say more about that. We traditionally made these plots versus transverse momentum until a clever person realized that actually the so-called transverse kinetic energy would be a better variable with which to characterize this flow pattern. And here you see the reason why, is it unifies those disparate mass-dependent curves for pions, protons, and kaons. And you can understand that, if you like, as a simple consequence of the work energy theorem. Work is done on the fluid. The work gained by individual particles from pressure gradients is translated into a change in their kinetic energy. And this so-called MT is a good approximation to the kinetic energy, at least at 90 degrees in the with respect to the beam axis. But you still see that there are two separate curves at high KET in this case, as opposed to PT. But we can further understand those two branches if we recall that if you look at them in detail, you'll see that they're separately for baryons and mesons. And if we put in the very simple fact that mesons contain two quarks, two constituent quarks, baryons three, if we scale the axes by factors of three in both cases, what you see is those two curves unify. And this strongly suggests that, in fact, the flow pattern is done at the constituent level and not imprinted at the very end of the collision when the particles turn back into hadrons. So all of that is consistent with ideal fluid hydrodynamics. That's what you would predict from the notion of ideal fluid hydrodynamics. But that, of course, requires zero viscosity. So a logical question to ask is, what is the viscosity of the material created at RIC? And here you see an estimate of it in conventional units, in Pascal seconds. Now, this coefficient 2, it could equally well be 1 or 4, but I have the order of magnitude right. I'm certain about that. I don't have any intuition for what that means, but let's compare it to something we all know, the viscosity of water. It's about 10 to the minus 3 Pascal seconds. That is to say, the ratio is something like 10 to the 14th. So it's kind of hard to understand why people are excited about a so-called perfect fluid behavior at RIC with a viscosity that large. For a comparison, let's look at the viscosity of pitch. It's actually pretty close to a QGP within factors of 1,000. But the nice thing about the real world is you can find any viscosity you like. If you look at the viscosity of glass at the annealing point, it's essentially 10 to the 12th Pascal seconds. So again, comparable, a little bit greater than the very large viscosity of quark-gluon plasma. So this seems a little strange why perfect fluid dynamics would apply. The answer, the resolution, of course, is trivial, but I will put it off for one moment. Okay? And putting it off for one moment is what I want to do is now look at the probes of the dense matter that is created in these collisions. How can we probe them? Well, what we can do is essentially do Rutherford scattering using the fact that we have high PT particle production, at least in principle, in the initial collision, and use the emergence of those high PT particles to probe the material that they're traveling through. It's very important when you do that that you have control of your baseline, of the proton-proton behavior of high PT particle production at the same root S. And that's why it's been such a tremendous advantage to have the SPIN program also working at RIC, so we have detailed measurements of transverse momenta spectra for proton-proton collisions covering some 8 orders of magnitude. And the curves on here are the predictions of perturbative QCD. You can see from that very good agreement, in fact, that we have our baseline under control. And so we have a calibrated probe that we can apply to now nucleus-nucleus collisions. So if you make the corresponding measurement in gold-gold collisions, here you see transverse momenta spectra for gold-gold collisions, in this case for pi zeros, the same particle that was on the previous plot. And this raft of various plots here are for various centralities, that is, degrees of overlap in the initial collision. Now, what one can do is to scale these transverse momenta spectra by the corresponding version for the proton-proton collisions, appropriately scaled so that known U physics, in other words, if a gold-gold collision produced high PT particles at the same rate as a corresponding proton-proton collision, you would define that to be unity in your scaling process. So let's do that, and we'll start with the most peripheral collisions where the overlap is very small and should look most proton-proton-like. So here the baseline is 1. That's known U physics. I've divided out the proton-proton spectra. This is a plot of that ratio as a function of momenta. And you can see as you go to increasing overlap between the nuclei, a suppression pattern that's absolutely systematic. And as you go to the most central 5% of these collisions, it's essentially dead flat, at least at high transverse momenta. And the effect is large. It's not a 30% effect. It's a factor of 5 effect. So indeed, there appears to be some tremendous suppression of high transverse momenta particle production. Now, we can say much more than that, thanks to a wonderful paper from the STAR collaboration that did what a particle physicist would do and say that in a high PT event, there are, of course, jets are produced. I have a leading particle on one side, but on the other side of the beam axis in azimuth, I would expect to find the so-called awayside jet. So let's look at that in proton-proton collisions. In a control measurement in deuteron-gold collisions, in which you have one heavy nucleus, but one obviously very light nucleus, and in gold-gold collisions. What you see is that in proton-proton collisions, that's in black, and in d-gold collisions, that's in red, you see the awayside peak over here at delta phi of pi, that is to say 180 degrees. But in the gold-gold collisions, those are the blue data points, it's completely absent. So the awayside partner is totally absorbed by the medium. So if you want to see this in some cartoon takeaway message, what you can see is that we do see high PT particles. That's presumably a surface bias. So only those collisions that occur near the surface of the collision emerge. But in fact, the awayside partner dives back into the depth of the material, and it's completely absorbed by the medium. This is our understanding of the so-called disappearance of the awayside jet. So indeed, in order for that to happen, we must have a very dense medium. And that, in fact, turns out to be the resolution of that very large viscosity that I quoted at the beginning, very large in conventional units. But of course, any engineer would have immediately realized what's going on, because engineers, being smart people, know that what's important is kinematic viscosity, viscosity divided by the density. That measure, then gives you something in which you, in effect, remove the inertial effects and has these dimensions. So eta, viscosity divided by mass density, is what engineers often tabulate. Now, any relativist will tell you, but in a truly relativistic system, of course, instead of mass density, what I should have is energy density. And if I look at the appropriate components in the stress-energy tensor, energy energy density plus pressure in this form. And any thermodynamicist presented with that will say, oh, that's really just the enthalpy density. That's just another name for it. But it turns out its zero chemical potential is equal to the temperature times the entropy density. So that means that if we can extend this notion of kinematic viscosity in this way to eta divided by mass density divided by epsilon plus p, what it turns out to be is eta over s, a damping coefficient, times a 1 over T, a corresponding thermal time. So the key parameter is not viscosity by itself. It's viscosity divided by entropy density, and it's a measure of damping. So before proceeding, let me try and summarize what I've presented to this at this point, is that the initial discoveries at RIC have clearly indicated that essentially perfect fluid behavior of the matter that's produced, and that it's extraordinarily dense. That's the capsule summary of those results. And that matter is about as far away in its behavior and its characteristics from an asymptotically free gas of quarks and gluons as possible. That's the key conclusion thus far. But of course, being physicists, we'd like to quantify those statements. So how can we do that? Well, it turns out that the viscosity to entropy density is a key observable. Observable is not quite the right word, a key parameter. But before proceeding with that, I'd like to make sure that we're all on the same page in developing our intuition about viscosity. I think we all appreciate that that it corresponds to momentum transport between quote-unquote layers in a fluid, the so-called shear stress. Now, that means that viscosity is somehow the momentum density times the mean free path, and indeed, dimensionally, it's the number density times the mean momentum per particle in the system times the mean free path. But if you haven't thought about it, it leads to the strange notion that in a dense system that has a small mean free path, that's when you'll have a small viscosity, not a large viscosity. And a ideal hydrodynamics, of course, requires that the mean free path go to zero. And so almost built into the notion of applying hydrodynamics, having a small mean free path in your system, you're forced to assume as a result that the viscosity should run to zero. But it turns out that, in fact, you can't set the viscosity arbitrarily to zero. It's forbidden, we think, perhaps, maybe, because that strong coupling should imply a small viscosity, but there's a bound. There's a bound that's been conjectured by Covington, Sun, and Starinets, that eta over s, this parameter, is 1 over 4 pi times h bar divided by Boltzmann's constant, 1 over 4 pi, or it must be equal or greater than 1 over 4 pi in natural units. And while the first thing you would do is interrogate ordinary matter and see if it respects that bound, here you see plots of that ratio, eta over s, actually multiplied by 4 pi. So the bound would be at unity for water, for nitrogen, and for liquid helium, liquid and gaseous, at various pressures. And you see that they're all, even at their minima, well above the bound, which would be 1 in these units. And as far as we can tell, the fluid created at RIC might very well be at 2 or 3 on this scale, that is to say, below the minima of all of the real-world materials, except at a temperature that is off-scale on this plot, even logarithmically. So how is that bound derived? That's the very intriguing connection that has been so stimulating. It was derived exploiting the Maldacena's conjecture about ADS-CFT. And the precise mechanism is actually rather neat and rather universal, is that you take the ADS-CFT correspondence. In this particular case, you want to describe a thermal system. So you thermalize it with a black grain. And then on very general arguments, viscosity can be mapped onto absorption cross-sections on that black grain. So a graviton propagating in the bulk will be absorbed by the brain, and the corresponding excitations are the gauge degrees of freedom as viewed from the boundary. So you can perform a calculation of the viscosity. It's proportional to the area of that brain, but in this particular space, that is not a black hole. It's got an infinite area, but of course that immediately suggests that one would normalize it by the corresponding entropy or entropy density, which also is proportional to the area. And that leads very nicely to this bound. You'll hear more about the general notion of applying ADS-CFT to these collisions from Krishna Rajagopal in the talk to follow. So how can we extract and measure eta over s, viscosity to entropy density, from RIC collisions? Well, I originally had measure, but I decided it was much more honest to say estimating that value. We can use it from phenomena that, from which we can see damping, such as the damping of flow in these collisions. Here you see a couple of estimates that are in the published literature. We can look at how fluctuations, how in the case of soft particle transverse momentum fluctuations are damped as you go away from the central region of the collision. That leads to another estimate for eta over s within factors of 4 of the bound. You can look at how charm quarks lose energy and flow with the medium. It's actually surprising that even a heavy quark such as charm appears to be thermalized, flows with the medium, and loses energy in the same way the light quarks do. That again leads to an estimate for eta over s within a factor of 2 of the bound. Now, what's very interesting is to compare this notion that we are within factors of 2 or 3 or 4 of the fundamental conjectured bound on viscosity to entropy density with another system in which one is able to tune it and change this ratio of viscosity to entropy density. And those are cold fermions in an atomic trap as studied by John Thomas at Duke and others, by varying the strength of the coupling between the atoms, he is able to essentially vary this viscosity to entropy density ratio and to tune it in a very simple way. Here you see a plot of it running down. This is now, the bound would be at 0.08, 1 over 4 pi, as indicated by this line. That's where RIC, QGP simulations, string theory suggests that we are. And they can come essentially arbitrarily close to that bound. Now, what's very interesting is to look at how you extract that viscosity from the cold atomic atoms. It's a very simple, it's not quite a freshman physics calculation. But the damping rates is simply given by, if you like, the power F dot V into the modes, the damping of the breathing modes, and it's a straightforward calculation. The corresponding calculation for the fluid created at RIC requires that you have very good control of so-called second-order causal relativistic hydrodynamics. You can find a discussion of the difficulties of doing that in this very nice article from the Living Reviews in Relativity. And here's what happens when you write down those equations. And you can see that the level of complexity is significantly different. And in fact, there have been major advances in how one implements that and how one even understands some of the terms that are involved, again, deriving some insight from hydrodynamics on the ADS-CFT side. Here is just but one example of that. So when you implement this, now I think the community of people studying RIC collisions have done really major advances in understanding causal second-order relativistic hydrodynamics for a system that's intrinsically relativistic for on all scales. There are many plots here, and I won't lead you through them. But what you can see is that for various values of eta over s, ideal is the green curve. The value at the saturates the bound, 1 over 4 pi, is the red curve. These are various observables, all simultaneously calculated, and I think one of the most more advanced calculations by Romachka and Romachka. And you'd see there is not perfect agreement with the data, but indeed, as far as we know at the moment, is that we're within a factor of 2 of the bound, but there is some consistency even if one goes below the bound, and that is uses purely ideal calculations. So that's how difficult it is to measure a number that is only slightly different, if you like, from zero. Now, in the concluding couple of minutes, I'd like to present you with one more parameter to consider. And I vividly remember a discussion with the next speaker in 2005 asking him whether or not it was conceivable that, well, we have all these calculations of eta over s using the gravity dual approach. Is it possible to do energy loss? And Krishna was rather skeptical. And about 6 weeks later, I think his first paper on the topic emerged. So how do we parameterize the energy loss in these collisions? There is a parameter, Q hat, which is essentially a measure of the mean momentum transferred to the medium divided by mean squared momentum, I should say, per unit path length. And then the energy loss due to radiative processes is proportional to that Q hat parameter. It's proportional to the length squared in the medium because it's a non-abelian energy loss mechanism. So a detailed statistical analysis of the energy loss systematics of that same distribution I showed you where unity was no effect by the Phoenix collaboration and also by these authors who provided their data. What you see here is a function of the value of this Q hat measured in GeV squared for Fermi, various parameterizations as compared to the data. And you do a chi-squared analysis, and you get a value of order 13, plus or minus about 2. Now, when you do the corresponding ADS-CFT calculation, that's done using a Wilson loop, whose turns into a string world sheep dangling down into the bulk. You'll hear more about that in the next talk. What do you find? First of all, you find you get a nice analytic result for a Q-hat, something you don't get when you try to calculate it imperturbative QCD, and you get a value of about 5 plus or minus, well, I don't know how to do an error estimate on it. There is a large error estimate because this explicitly depends on the at-hoof parameter, the coupling in the medium, and there is not an unambiguous prescription for how you translate that back into ordinary QCD from N equals 4 supersymmetric Yang-Mills. So a skeptic would say that factor of three difference between the ADS CFT and this means that it's excluded at the three sigma level. I don't take that approach at all because I think anything within factors of 10 can be interpreted as success in this game, where we're really dealing with a plasma that is otherwise, whose properties are uncalculable via perturbative methods. So in fact, that leads me to assert that in a way there's a primacy of QCD, is that what we've done is found this very interesting connection back onto string theory and supersymmetric Yang-Mills. The weak form of that, of course, is the Maldacena conjecture. A stronger form you can find in this nice article by Horowitz and Polchinski that asserts within every non-abelian gauge theory, even the weak, in our case, the strong nuclear interaction, is a theory of quantum gravity. That's a pretty strong assertion, but I would like to be even a little stronger in that assertion. Whether or not that happens to be true, at the moment, experimentally, it's only with QCD. In our case, it's not a nasty background we have to understand. It's the main event. And only with QCD can we experimentally explore this fascinating connection of thermal gauge theories with perhaps more fundamental physics. And we, in fact, makes me perhaps assert that it's not quantum, not quark-gluon plasma, but better thought of as, I want to preserve the acronym, so quantum gauge fluid. Now, I thought I was going over the top, but I realized I was only an amateur in this, and the real pro is Lenny Susskind. So he asserted that studying quantum gravity, it's blown up and slowed down by a factor of 10 to the 20th in these collisions. So that's, I find, a very nice way to put it. So to conclude, our paradigm shift, here is where we were circa 2000, and the assertion that that energy density was about 80% of the Stefan Boltzmann limit was essentially asymptotically free. What we've done is the same plot, the same 80%, but now we view that as almost infinitely coupled. And that's strongly motivated, I should add, by this famous result for the entropy density at infinite coupling as compared to zero coupling of being also near 80%. So my visual summary is that these two major discoveries from Rick indicate strongly coupled quark-gluon plasma, and they're consistent within factors of 2 to 3 of the ADS CFT results. And then said in words is that we have indeed made major discoveries that have resulted in a paradigm shift in our understanding of quark-gluon plasma and perhaps more general thermal gauge theories. And for more on this, I'll refer you to the next talk. Thank you.
Questions?
So I got confused a little bit when you were comparing the results of your measurement with a calculation by Krishna and others. So there was a factor of three discrepancy, right? And you said that the uncertainties are large, so within a factor of 10, it should be viewed as an agreement, right? But sort of naively, all dimensionful parameters should be factorized, and you have, you know, a number to calculate, which is, you know, presumably in any model would be some kind of order one. It's not like a factors of 10 to the power 10 floating around, right? So how is it a success?
You are correct that dimensionally you would say that this has to be proportional to temperature cubed. There's no other scale in the problem, and so we need to calculate that coefficient. Now, I think you're correctly calling me on hyperbole, saying a factor of 10. A factor of 10 probably wouldn't be regarded as good. The factor of 3 discrepancy doesn't bother me terribly much because there's a non-robustness in the extraction of Q hat from the experimental data. You saw the process by which we tried to do this in the Phoenix collaboration. But within the model of the nuclear collision that you use to do that extraction, there are perhaps factors of 2 that are not reflected in a corresponding systematic error. So knowing that that Q-hat number statistically is 13 plus or minus 2, but with an unknown systematic. And then on the ADS-CFT side, there is another unknown systematic in where, how do I evaluate the coupling? What do I put in for the coupling? What was done there, I believe, was just the most naive mapping the coupling of super Yang mills directly onto the QCD coupling constant. So there's factors of two there as well.
More questions? Maybe such a naive question. I think at the beginning of your talk, you mentioned the geometry of the colliding configuration is very important. On
yes.
the other hand, you have thermalization, which apparently implies some type of isotropization or the loss of geometry.
So the question is, how is thermalization and isotropization consistent with the fact that the geometry is asymmetric? It's the other way around. The fact that we see asymmetries in the final state, but all particle yields are consistent with thermal production, tells us that the thermalization must occur very early in the collision process when there are still pressure gradients and spatial anisotropies. And those spatial anisotropies and pressure gradients get transmitted via hydrodynamics into this so-called elliptic flow, the asymmetry in the final state.
Okay, thank you.
Well, let's speak again.
And the next speaker is Krishna.